Hi, everyone. My name is Natalie Gochner, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political right, John Dougal. Hi, John.
Hey, always great to be with you.
And on the political left, Shireen Gourbani.
Hello, and hey to the listeners. Appreciate you tuning in.
All right. I don't know where to start this week, but I'm going to start with the Highland Park, Illinois mass shooting. Our producer mentioned off air that the videos of this were apocalyptic, which really sent a chill down my spine. What are we up to? Seven victims that have died at this point, and about nine others remain hospitalized. Whoa, and a 4th of July parade, Shireen? This is chilling, and, you know, they continue.
Yeah, of course, we live in a country where mass shootings are happening more than every day, so we've had more mass shootings than we have had days this year so far. This one, again, I just think we continue to see places that feel like they should be safe disrupted, because in a country where we have the kind of access to guns that we have, where we have, I think, just tensions rising on all sorts of fronts, it's difficult to really feel safe anywhere anymore.
Mm-hmm. John, obviously a deeply troubled gunman from what we've been learning. It's also clear that the protections really failed. And this was a man who legally purchased five firearms, even though the police had been notified about some of his challenges, a suicide attempt, a threat to kill everyone. What do you learn from this, if anything?
Well, unfortunately, what we see here from my perspective is yet another example where we've got these warning signs of a troubled individual who clearly shouldn't have firearms. And yet, despite going through four background checks and other things like that, was still allowed to purchase. And so we sit there and talk about certain restrictions for troubled individuals. And yet, time and time again, we're seeing troubled individuals that the background check is not triggering on these kind of police incidents or reports and other things like that.
Mm-hmm. John, are you familiar with that quote, feed men and then ask of them virtue?
No, I haven't.
Feed men and then ask of them virtue. But it's this idea, it's from the Grand Inquisitor, but it's this idea that until we take care of people's basic needs, very hard things happen. And when you see a situation like this, it's like, what in this man's background put him in a situation where he took these acts? And, you know, we can sit here and debate about gun safety, but I wonder if what we really should be doing is just coming together on mental health. And Shireen, I'll ask you to comment on that, and then John.
To be clear, we do not do enough to address healthcare broadly in this country, mental health care in particular. We lose far too many individuals to suicide, which we've talked about, you know, numerous times on this show. And we know that it's particularly lethal in the West because often people pick up a gun. I mean, Natalie, what you're suggesting here is actually what I'm orienting a huge chunk of my professional life around. What mm-hmm. are we doing to meet basic needs of individuals so that we can think holistically about what it means to be safe in our society, what it means to have opportunity, what it means to have food on the table, families that are able to be emotionally available to bring kids into this world in a way that they have the capacity and the capability to take care of them. And then on top of that, right, like that they're able to find good jobs, get, you know, an education, find safety in communities that has good sidewalks mm-hmm. and mass transit. Like all of these things are degraded in our society. Unfortunately, we don't have as much infrastructure as many other industrialized countries have. And we absolutely have a failing of our mental health system. But we cannot ignore the fact that time after time, when we see these mass shootings, people typically on the right want to turn to mental health. And yes, it is an issue. It is a critical piece of this mm-hmm. issue. But we also have more guns and greater availability than any other country on earth.
John, at the Gardner Institute in 2019, one of our talented researchers, Lara Summers, helped with this report on Utah's mental health system. This is pre-pandemic, but she called it a mental health crisis, increasing suicide rates, untreated anxiety and depression among our youth, traumatic brain injuries, and a lot of indications that we need more accessible, affordable, and comprehensive mental health services. I wonder if there's a way on Capitol Hill to come together on this, you know, where Utah could really lead and invest more. We have a shortage of mental health providers. And so invest more in people in need and invest more in the training for people who can help them. Your comment, John.
Well, I was going to say, from my perspective, clearly, whenever we see somebody engage in this kind of horrific behavior, we chalk it up to mental health. I think there's probably a broader issue in terms of self-esteem and other stresses in people's lives that's above and beyond just mental health. Mm-hmm. One of the other challenges, and clearly trying to help folks in their times of need and to help them bridge these kind of difficulties in their life so they don't stoop to this kind of behavior is important. But one of the challenges we have is most folks that are dealing with stress don't engage in these kind of behaviors. The mm-hmm. overwhelming majority don't. And so that's why it's so hard for us to identify, here's the person that has mental health challenges or other esteem issues that is going to become violent versus those that don't. And it's kind of the needle in the haystack kind of challenge of, I think it's good to broadly reach out and help in our schools, in our society, you know, difficulties in workplace. I mean, it's we've all been through different stresses in our life. But clearly, as you've both articulated, there are some of those cases that I don't fully understand that are above and beyond medical issues in terms mm-hmm. of depression, suicide, and those type of levels.
Yeah.
And I think engaging deeper and deeper into really troubling corners of the internet, you know, I mean, we're seeing isolation and engagement in spaces that are radicalizing people in this country. And that is also in a place where we just simply do not have good tools to disrupt. And we don't always have support systems around people to help bring people back out of that kind of, I think that there's absolutely no reason that we shouldn't just be calling it radicalization because we're seeing it over and over.
Well, and online isn't a great place for discussion and dialogue. We have a good discussion among ourselves, even when we disagree vehemently about certain issues. You get online and social media, it's not really the best place to have a meaningful engagement, a meaningful discussion.
Mm-hmm. That's the truth.
I bring it up in this context because I like the idea of Governor Cox, Speaker Wilson, President Adams, the Utah Congressional Delegation, our lieutenant governor, our capital city mayor, and our capital county mayor. I love the idea of them standing up, like with the congressional delegation, and say, in Utah, here's something we can come together on. And it will help with poverty. It will help with housing. It will help with mass shootings. It will help with everything if we come together and address mental health in a way that is very pro-family, you know, and pro-kids. So just an idea coming out of both sides.
I'm here for it. If any of those people are listening, let's do it.
Yeah. Well, so some other things. So that would be coming together here in Utah. But in Washington, we can't seem to come together. President Biden obviously proposed a carve out for the filibuster on abortion. And he's got good old Senators Manchin and Sinema saying, no, no, John. This Senator Sinema, I mean, I was used to it from Manchin, but she's really something. I'd love to hear your commentary, John.
Well, I think, you know, if you're in the Senate, there's an interesting dynamic when they talk about the filibuster. And folks would contend that Harry Reid's change to the filibuster when it came to certain judges and the appointment of those judges and their confirmation process then flipped when the Republicans were in control and they got rid of the filibuster when it came to Supreme Court justices. And mm-hmm. so they're saying, wait a second, you know, if we get rid of it for abortion on the one side, then as soon as the Republicans are in control, then they're going to ban it nationwide. And we want to make sure the filibuster stays in there to avoid this kind of 50-50 flip-flopping back and forth, to have something that's a little more substantial in terms of support and adoption.
Yeah. Shireen, I mean, the way they use these terms in Washington, cloture, filibuster, nuclear option.
Yeah.
But they all... when you're in power, you use them. And when you're not in power, you are just horrified that those powers exist.
Yeah, I have no doubt that if we were in a reverse position with this thin of a margin for Republican leadership, that we would have already seen the disintegration of the filibuster. And I honestly am shocked that we're not taking this opportunity to address incredibly critical and large-scale issues that we are facing, everything from environmental policy to certainly protecting reproductive justice, reproductive rights in this country, and on and on and on down the list. There is so much that we are unable to get done, and I do think that it is a dream, a wish, a hope. I just can't believe that Republicans would not would not end the filibuster. Yeah. And I think that we should be taking this opportunity to take action.
John, some call it a flip.
Shereen, let me make sure I understand. Are you saying they should get rid of the filibuster because you believe the Republicans are going to get rid of it in the future?
Yes. And I don't believe that we're in like a good faith negotiation system here. And I think that we have to be doing everything that we can to pass policy, especially on the critical issues that we are facing. It is not going to get done. We do not. Democrats consistently are coming to the table with ideas. And what we're hearing over and over again from Republicans, frankly, is no. And I just don't see a way out of that that gets us to 60 votes anytime soon.
Yeah, good point. Just in the next minute here, John and Shereen, I mean, we did have a 10-year-old rape survivor who was barred from receiving an abortion in Ohio because of the trigger law and had to travel to, was it Indiana, to have medical services. 10 years old, John. Well, didn't prevent an abortion.
And worse
and just
than 10,
put this woman,
a victim of rape. Let's remember.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not some kind of consensual act. This is rape.
Okay? Yeah.
And this is why I think Utah is in a good place from my perspective. It's got what I think are appropriate accommodations for criminal acts and the health of the mother.
Yeah.
So I'll just say that there was a recent article in the Salt Lake Tribune where the district attorney in the county attorney in Davis County said that while we do have this carve out that says, you know, in the case of rape or incest, and I've said before, I think there's deep brutality in the fact that it requires a police report or a report to the appropriate authorities. It's very poorly defined. And we know that most people simply do not report and they don't report for a wide range of reasons. And that's not me saying that. That's the district attorney in Davis County saying it. So understand that people on the right are also deeply distressed by the way that the law has been constructed. And what we simply know is that that does not meet the needs of people who are victims of rape or incest. And that alone, I mean, that is to me barbaric. But then there's this kind of other layer where I do believe that women should be able to choose their futures and understand that there are certainly reasonable restrictions on that, that I think we could maybe come to closer agreement on. But it should not only be in the cases of rape and incest, but it should also be in the cases where women simply know that they are not in a position to raise a child.
You're listening to Shereen Gourbani on the left, John Dougal on the right. I'm Natalie Gochner. Let's take a break. But in our next segment, we're going to talk about climate and offshore oil drilling. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shereen Gourbani on the left.
John Dougal still on the right.
And Natalie Gochner, I'm in the political center, and we are all celebrating, I think it's fair to say, from the left, the right, and the center, that we had the first Black woman Supreme Court justice sworn in last week, Ketanji Brown Jackson. John, you know, she was appointed by a Democrat, but I think you are excited about this appointment.
Well, I may have concerns about her judicial temperament, but I think in terms of American history, this is a critical glass ceiling that's broken. To see somebody of this qualification reach the bench. I mean, yeah. I think it says something about the American dream.
John, I'll say from the political middle, whether you agree with her judicial temperament, philosophy, whatever, I think that's the whole point, is that everybody gets people on the court that represent some part of their life, right? If they all were just like you, that would be a problem. We're, you know, this pluralistic society. No, I don't. I'm looking at John and waving my hands.
I'm just joking.
Exactly. I mean, that's what it represents. You know,
I mean, we talk about two different sides of the aisle in terms of the bench, but you see all sorts of mixing of different philosophies and different coalitions on different issues.
Yeah, if they're all the same, we should have a smaller court. Maybe we get by with one person. Shereen?
Maybe we should expand the court, which I'm into. But I have to agree, this was a historic moment. I think it's an incredible moment. I'm excited for her to be there and look forward to hearing her input on decisions that are coming forward.
Mm-hmm. So we got the Supreme Court. They ruled sharply that to limit EPA's power to combat the climate crisis. This is, of course, taking care of carbon emissions from power plants. 6-3 ruling. Not surprisingly, it was West Virginia versus EPA. So you can think of West Virginia as a huge coal state. I used to work at EPA. I know what this is like. I remember Supreme Court cases being discussed frequently in the senior staff meetings at EPA. All I know is it was a big deal when EPA was able to have the power to regulate carbon emissions, and it's a big deal when they lose the power to regulate carbon emissions. Shireen?
So I think that this is just a terrible time as we're thinking about the drought that we're in, as we're thinking about the climate chaos that we're seeing across this country and around this world. We need to move faster and we need to do more when we're thinking about the impacts of climate change. And that's why I think this ruling is really such a setback. But I do have to say it's not as bad as it could have been. But it's interesting to me, and maybe you can speak more to this, but basically this was a proposal using the Clean Air Act that had not gone into place. So this is not something that was currently happening. And now they're told that they cannot do this. So I guess, you know, for me, it's just, what are we going to do and how do we utilize the EPA and actually every tool in our tool belt to move as quickly as possible to address climate change and to address things like our air quality in meaningful ways?
Yeah. John, it comes down to who do we allow to regulate? Is it enough if Congress does it? Is it enough if an executive agency does it? Or does the court get to decide if you get to regulate? And I thought it was interesting what Justice Kagan said, where she said the court appoints itself instead of Congress or the expert agency, the decision maker on climate policy. She thinks that's really frightening, right? Because normally they're saying Congress gets to decide.
Well, and Congress is the one that gets to decide, and Justice Kagan is up in the night with her statement. Because what the court said was not we're going to regulate, it is that the EPA stepped beyond what Congress allowed them to regulate. And now it's back to Congress to decide and articulate what they expect the EPA to do. My understanding is the program, what Congress delegated was the ability to regulate at the source, at the power plant, and EPA was trying to regulate at the grid. So above and beyond what they had authority to do. And in fact, the court said the EPA magically found this authority despite the fact that Congress has repeatedly not delegated to the EPA and has voted it down. Mm-hmm. And so what the court said is we're not going to regulate greenhouse gases and things. They said it is up to Congress to delegate to the agencies what is appropriate and what isn't appropriate, and an agency can't step beyond that.
Now what we need to do is end the filibuster and maybe we can get something done.
Hey, well, we also had President Biden. He proposed a new offshore oil and gas drilling proposal that really got under the skin of the climate watchdog groups. This was a campaign promise that he's moved on. You know, I mean, I think we're in a crisis, an energy crisis, and these people have got to work with the president on this. And Shireen, I know you're all about using this as a time to transition to clean energies, but I do think there's a balance.
Perhaps there is a balance. I'll just tell you, as we are in the most intense drought, I know we're going to talk about that we've experienced a prolonged drought here, as we're seeing fires rage across the West, as we're seeing summers get hotter and longer, this is not the right decision. It doesn't seem like this makes sense to me when we're thinking about the big picture. Yes, there are short-term needs that we absolutely are in a crisis when it comes to families being able to fill up their cars at the pump. But we also have got to meaningfully address the fact that we are living in a rapidly changing environment on this planet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. John, you probably saw, but they've done new estimates on the Great Salt Lake, and it's at an all-time low again. The new executive director of the Utah Department of Natural Resources had the quote, "This is not the type of record we like to break."
No, clearly. And the legislature last session took several steps to try and get more water flowing down to the Great Salt Lake. One of the interesting dynamics we have with water law, as I understand it, is basically use it or lose it. And so we have incentivized, you must use it, whether or not it's the best use of it, or else you're going to lose your water right. And so, you know, something that's a little bit smarter in terms of how we use our water, I think would be beneficial. But let me back up. One of the interesting things to what you were just speaking about, the Biden administration this past week was asked about the price of gas at the pump. And one of the folks from the administration said, this is about the future of the liberal world order, and we have to stand firm. I do not believe that that is a message that the American people, by and large, want to buy into. They do not want this liberal world order and gas prices through the roof, because it affects everything else in their life.
So, John, yeah. I would love to go back for just a moment to use it or lose it. When we're talking about that, are we talking about individuals? We're not talking about individual homeowners. Can you just color that out a little bit more so that people understand why the use it or lose it was so problematic?
So we may be talking individual homeowners, depending on who they are, probably more farmers and ranchers and large property owners, that if they and some governmental entities, yeah, that if they don't fully use their water rights, they may lose them,
right?
Because in essence, the state has oversubscribed.
Yes.
And so what that says is you must now use that water. You know, there's some limitations on whether you could lease it to somebody else or other things like that. How do you get it to the best use? But in essence, if you didn't use it, you ran the risk of losing.
And that's why this change is so good. This is a great change. So I just want to draw attention to that. It's really meaningful because we're talking about these kind of large scale places where we're losing a lot of water.
In the political middle, I just want to mention this, and John, you and I can talk off air, but when I hear liberal world order, I don't think of liberal conservative. I think of international relations and global rule-based relationships, political liberalism, economic liberalism, free trade. It's what The Economist magazine is all about. So we could talk off air, but they're not talking about liberal politics. They're talking about rule-based international orders that respect free markets.
That may be what you hear. I doubt that's what most of the American people hear.
I agree. And we got to teach people what liberalism really means, because liberalism isn't political. It's economic.
It's economic.
At least in world affairs. Hey, another thing we need to talk about. Mitt Romney, what a guy. I have not, in full disclosure, I've not read it fully, but I've seen some of the quotes and get the gist of it. He's written a really nice piece in The Atlantic. First of all, the placement in The Atlantic, that's sort of a left of center kind of thought leadership, you know, magazine. But he's really writing about how we're a nation in denial. And it looks to me to be very artfully done. He's raised issues such as climate change, illegal immigration, drought, inflation, national debt, and basically saying we're not facing them. John, have you read it? What did you take? And then Shireen, I'll ask you the same question.
I haven't had a chance to read it yet. I mean, I heard it was out there, but it's been a busy week. I think when you look at the broader issue and you step back, and I think Shireen probably would agree with me on a lot of this, is when you think about D.C., the whole system back there is in denial on so many different issues. I think, unfortunately, when it comes to fiscal matters, which is one of the most important matters from my perspective, America's society is in denial about our own personal debt, our spending, lack of savings, other things like that. And I tell folks that Congress is, when it comes to fiscal matters, a representation of the populace at large. And so too often, yeah, he's pointing out something that I think is a broader issue.
Shireen, how about this quote from the article? He said, a classic example of denial comes from Donald Trump. I won in a landslide. Perhaps this is a branch of the same delusion that leads people to feed money into slot machines. Because I really want to win, I believe that I will win.
Yeah. He wrote. So I did read this, a regular reader and subscriber to The Atlantic speaking here. I will say this. I found some elements of what Mitt Romney said to really resonate with me, especially as we're talking about really a broken institution not being able to meet the challenges that we have in this moment. But to me, what I also heard was this both sidesism that extends beyond, I think, the reality that we're living in, to suggest that because Biden's having a hard time getting things done, that that's equivalent to what we're seeing in terms of the radicalization or the following that somebody like Donald Trump has. And we're thinking about the actual like broader implications of that for American society and culture. The lies that undergird really everything that the Trump administration seemed to hold dear. And then Biden just simply not being able to build a healthy and functional coalition are not the same thing. So I really struggled with that element of it, though appreciate, really love that Mitch showed up in The Atlantic. And I like that he's trying to, I think, draw this conversation forward. But I do think there is a difference in what we're seeing on the right and the left in this country.
I'm excited to read it, and I'm wondering what's behind the motivation to write it and publish it and place it in the Atlantic.
Yeah, it's a good question.
Hey, so
I didn't see it in the Wall Street Journal.
We have Jen Plum and Senator Kitchen running neck and neck, so we'll keep an eye on that. But the last thing I want to bring up in the last minute or so that we have is this email that went to Senator Kurt Bramble. He's a Republican from Provo. This woman basically wrote to him. Can you summarize it for us, Shireen? You'll do a better job than I will.
I sure can. So really the specific question was, could you explain more about what the abortion trigger law will mean for women in Utah? And within 18 minutes, he responded and said, the explanation is that the trigger law will stop the barbaric slaughter of innocent unborn children. And she said, you know, I was messaging him in good faith with real worries, real concerns, which I've articulated here and happy to go into again on another episode. But he legitimately, she said he legitimately sounded like a Twitter troll, and there was no need for that. And I just couldn't agree more. I think we should expect more from our elected officials, especially when they're making decisions like this that are really dire for individuals who are thinking about reproducing and the challenges they may now face in this state.
John, we've only got 15 minutes, but Senator Bramble has strong opinions and positions, right?
Yeah, I don't think there's a harder working, smarter legislator up on the Hill than Kurt Bramble, but he is hard charging. And, you know, I think if he had to do it again, he'd probably reword it differently.
No, he said he wouldn't.
Well, my experience is quite very different, with Kurt in those matters. But, yeah. There's probably a more tactful way he could have worded that and still conveyed the message. And I tell folks that politics is the art of persuasion. And even when you disagree with something, someone, you're trying to persuade them to join your side and join your position.
We're going to have to make that a wrap. Natalie Gochner in the political center, John Dougal on the right, Shireen Gourvani on the left. Programs produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.